From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, September 24th. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and this is a bit of a taped introduction to this week's podcast because I'm taping this introduction late Thursday afternoon. Anthony York and I taped the podcast earlier this afternoon. And in the podcast, as you'll hear in a moment, we said, well, there's really nothing to tell you about the state budget because there is no state budget. So let's talk about other things in politics. Well, half of that is true. There's not much to tell you about a state budget, but apparently there is a budget agreement. Late Thursday afternoon, as you many of you will have already heard by the time you hear this podcast on Friday morning, the governor and the four legislative leaders say they have a framework of a tentative budget deal. Those are lots of qualifiers. We don't know a lot of details. Frankly, we hardly know any details at this point, but they're apparently working on it through the weekend, and we'll have more on Monday. And, of course, next week we will be able to talk more about what's in this budget deal, who wins, who loses, on the podcast for that week. So this is a little bit of an introduction to say, yes, you're going to hear us joke about the lack of a budget in a moment. And we were wrong. I guess that's what we get for making those statements. But, hey, maybe we prodded them to make a deal. So here's the rest of the podcast that we taped about the polls and the race for governor. And thanks for your patience in us getting it wrong. Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly, here with me in the studio. We're poring over poll numbers.
Hold on. I'm pouring.
Pouring. Yeah, exactly. Is that, well, different kind of pouring.
Yes.
What are we pouring? Maybe we should be pouring.
Pouring.
You know, a drink or two while we pour over the polls.
I have my nice iced coffee here.
Yeah, that's not really what I was thinking
no.
of. That you know, that might make the podcast a lot more fun, but we'll have to...
Alcohol? Yeah, perhaps.
Fun or even less predictable than its already unpredictable nature. Okay. So we would, you know, talk about the state budget, except that here on day 84 of the fiscal year, ain't nothing to talk about.
Nope. Except a party in L.A.
Yeah. A couple of days of Big Five meetings in Santa Monica. The governor's office is there. The governor's been under the weather, by the way. Feel better, Gov.
I hear it's lovely there this time of year.
Yeah. He tweeted that he had 102 temperature, but even that couldn't keep him down. So.
Yeah, well. My hometown, Santa Monica.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
So maybe you should be down there staking out the budget meeting for all of us reporters who...
Sammo hi. Go Vikings.
...have no travel budget for that. So, you know, we don't know what to tell you on that. I think the budget's going to come up here in a moment as we talk about all kinds of ugly political things this election season. But stay tuned on that lovely state budget, now the latest in California history.
Okay.
That sounds like a...
dun, dun, and another news.
Exactly right. So stay tuned here to your channel, your local podcast channel.
Now back to Barney Miller.
Is the governor's race Barney Miller? In which case, who's fish?
Before my time.
Okay.
I don't know.
So let's talk about polls. And actually, a lot of little things to ticky-tack, or maybe the campaigns don't think they're ticky-tack, in the race for governor. A little bit of the U.S. Senate race to talk about. Race for governor first. Field poll that came out on Thursday. There have been a lot of different, I don't want to be mean to the other polls, but littler polls that have been out over the last few weeks.
Field has been reliable.
Yeah, but
less
Field
reliable.
Has been around for a while. I think those of us in the press tend to trust Field, especially because they show us their whole data and on and on and on. Some will disagree with that, but hey, let's move on.
We can talk about it. In November.
Good. Let's do that. So field poll shows dead heat. Jerry Brown, 41. Meg Whitman, 41. 18% undecided. That's a slight tick down for Brown and a slight tick down for Whitman from Field in July.
Race to the bottom.
In July, they had the race at 44-43. Brown up by a point. Now, again, as we said, 41-41. So not a lot of difference there. Anthony's been spending lots of time with all the details of this poll. But the only other detail I'd say right off the top is that when they asked, is your vote more of a vote for your candidate or against the opponent, Whitman voters say 49% of them said I'm voting for my candidate, 48% said I'm voting against Jerry. Jerry's voters, 53% said I'm voting for Jerry, 45% said I'm voting against Meg.
Comparable.
Yeah, comparable. Exactly. Slightly better for Brown there, but people aren't very interested in these two. I mean, that's what Mark DiCamillo, the field poll director, said to a lot of us, and you know, the numbers seem to bear him out.
And it's interesting that you have nearly 20% of the electorate here, you know, less than 6 weeks before the election, still undecided. And I mean, look, it's not rocket science. Those late deciding voters are going to be are going to determine who wins this race. And you know, the advantage is with Brown, just because of the registration advantage and the turnout advantage the Democrats will have on Election Day. But I think the Whitman campaign can make a compelling case that if Brown hasn't closed the deal by now, if those voters are still up for grabs, and that's still good news for Whitman.
Well, certainly one thing that I think we can probably safely say is that voters who have not voters who are still undecided, and I can't say all of them, but you've got to think that a lot of the voters, you're looking at the poll results, you're trying
to look
at something.
I wanted to see the date of the polling dates, so keep talking. The
polling date was ended just last week, I believe. Went through the 21st of September. And that's always one of the things that people point to, is because a poll is a snapshot in time, you know, what was going on in the campaign when the pollsters were out there asking the questions. I think it was the week ending the 21st of September. But
it was after Brown had been on the air.
A little bit. But the point I was going to make is that you've got to think that there are a lot of these undecided voters who are not undecided for any other reason other than they just can't figure out who to pick. It's not because they don't know who's running and they don't know enough about them. I mean, if Meg Whitman hasn't made enough of a case as to who she is in some way after $110 million plus of spending since the primary and general combined and Jerry Brown and 40 years in California politics, I mean, these aren't people who, I don't know who that person is.
Well, right, and that's what both campaigns today are making the case. Hey, she hasn't closed the deal after spending $125 million, and he hasn't closed the deal after 40 years. I thought what was interesting in the breakdown of the poll results is that older voters 65 and over strongly favor Brown, and younger voters, I believe the 18 to 24 and the 25 to, you know, those types. The post-college transitional year voters are Brown supporters, and it's everyone else who's sort of up for grabs or who leans Whitman. So, you know, again, another big determination will be who turns out to vote.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because a lot of the things we keep hearing about the polls are what their turnout models are. Now, we know that Democrats have a strong voter registration advantage. Is it 14
points? 14 points.
14 points in the latest data from the Secretary of State. Yet all of the polling agencies have to make determinations about what they think the percentage of Democrats, Republicans, independents, others are going to be when they turn out.
Right.
And people will either applaud or attack a poll based on what that projection is.
Right.
In the field poll, their projection is that Democrats will turn out slightly lower than their registration numbers, right?
Yeah, it's about an 8-point – that 14-point advantage shrinks to about 8 points. And I spoke to Mark DiCamillo Thursday about this, and he made – you know, I was sort of trying to get at how polls make that determination. He said that they kind of self-select. It's derived from the data, that they determine likely voters based on past voting history. That's something that's public record that pollsters can see. And then they talk to these voters, how likely, you know, and ask them if they're likely to vote, how likely they are to vote. And so
wouldn't that, you think that's a benefit, too, of having a real person asking the questions versus the robo-polls?
Yeah, that's why we don't report on the robo-polls like SurveyUSA. And that's another podcast. We can talk about that later. But that this turnout model, Mark DiCamillo was saying, is largely determined by, I mean, one of the things that you can measure in the poll from the turnout model is voter enthusiasm. And so Republicans are more likely to turn out beyond their registration numbers this year. I think that's usually the case. Typically higher turnout elections benefit Democrats because there are more of them. And a lot of the low propensity voters are Democrats. So this year, that's one of the advantages that Republicans have, you know, comparative to other years. Going this year is they're more likely to come to the polls than Democrats.
What I also found interesting in in talking to Mark about this poll was the sense that the voter unhappiness with the choices they have might lead him to conclude and others to conclude, and I think it's an interesting point, that voter turnout could be unusually low for a gubernatorial election.
Right.
In which case, right, who are the people that turn out then? Who's motivated even in the midst of a campaign where they don't like either guy or gal,
right,
to come out and do this?
And a couple of weeks.
And I should say to either come out or to vote by mail, which of course is an interesting element unto itself.
That starts in a week and a half. But this was something that the Brown campaign has alluded to when Steve Glazer, Brown's campaign manager, was in town to unveil one of Brown's first ads. That was something that he alluded to. He thought there would be a low turnout because it's such a negative campaign, and it almost seemed like this was part of the strategy of the Brown campaign at this point, is to drive down those voters. You know, a lot of these independent voters, 20% roughly of the state's voters are registered as declined to state voters, and they're the first ones to turn off in an election. And so if they stay home, that just adds to Brown's advantage because there are so many more Democrats in California than there are Republicans.
That being said, I mean, you know, I don't think either one of us can definitively say, you know, in a tied poll, who's the winner, who's the loser out of it. But as I was saying to Anthony before we started this, I'm not saying that Meg Whitman wins this poll. So that's this is me parsing my words here very carefully. But I have a hard time seeing how this is a good poll for Jerry Brown, given. You know, the Brown campaign will make a lot of hay about the fact that she spent all this money and she's still only even in the polls. But she's running neck and neck in a plurality Democratic state. And you look at the subsets of voters, his numbers aren't great. You look by region, his numbers aren't terribly strong. L.A. County,
he's not terribly,
or Los Angeles area, he's not terribly great in. San Francisco and the Bay Area, he's great. That's about it.
Right.
Even if you look at among Democrats, his support among Democrats is lower than Whitman's is among Republicans. Not by a ton, but by enough that would make me wonder if there's at least a little bit of truth. Maybe not as much as some particular strategists get quoted in the paper all the time saying, but if there's not a little kernel of truth of some Democrats who are not terribly enthused,
clearly,
by their choice.
Clearly it's there.
Yeah.
Clearly it's there. And I believe 15% of Democrats are voting for Whitman. Or said they would vote for Whitman in this poll, whereas only 9% of Republicans would vote for Brown.
And the gender gap, that's another one, where she's basically tied, right?
Yeah.
With Brown, and I didn't print out the whole poll, sorry. But she's basically tied with women with Brown.
Right.
And yet women are much more registered as Democrats than Republicans than those numbers would pan out.
And it's interesting, Whitman's stump speech this week, she's tweaked the fact that she's added that to her speech that, you know, if she's elected, she'll be the first female governor of California. She's clearly now more openly making a play for women voters, I think, on the stump.
Do you also think, too, that's why the Brown campaign is trying to light this small little backfire about abortion issues and choice issues?
And we saw it come from the Democratic Party today. The Democratic Party chairman, John Burton.
That's Thursday.
Made an allusion to it Thursday. Oh, right. Silly me. Not today. Thursday. Made an allusion about Whitman's record on abortion, and we'll see if that becomes a theme. There's been some mobilization. SEIU has moved $500,000 into an independent expenditure to do some Spanish language advertising for Brown. Another committee headed up by George Pla, a major player in the L.A. Latino political world, is formed to do some Spanish language and Latino outreach on Brown's behalf. And so, you know, Democrats are nervous. I think if you talk to folks, we heard some poll numbers floating around from union members that said that that Whitman is running unusually strong among union members, and so there's definitely nervousness. I think it's palpable here in Sacramento among political insiders about the Brown campaign. Now, whether that means Whitman will win, you know, we'll know in about 6 weeks.
And I'm going to circle this back again, this is just us being, sitting around trying to read the tea leaves to the point where they break apart, where we're spending so much time looking at them.
Yes.
But that caveat being said, we're sitting here, as I said at the top of the podcast, in the middle of the longest budget impasse in California history. We have no sign that this budget impasse is about to end in the immediate future. And you know, we've talked about this, I think, and other people have talked about suppose the impasse goes to Election Day, which used to seem absurd. Except now it's not quite as absurd as it used to be, given the dynamics of what's going on, given the pressure about campaigning and elections, and frankly, given, you know, whether some people want to put their name on the budget as the voters are about to go to the polls. And so all of that kind of comes back to me to wonder, is there any impact in the governor's race of this budget impasse? I don't know that there is. But one place that I'm curious about is that the incumbent governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, continues to hammer on the issue of pension reform. And maybe doesn't vilify public employees quite as much as some others have. Others
say Meg Whitman.
Well, or as Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, apparently said in L.A. with her, you know, that the teachers union are extortionists. But anyway, there's a symmetry there in some of the messaging about public employee unions, which goes back to the major financial contributors to Brown and Democrats. I wonder if that doesn't hurt Brown in some ways if the budget impasse continues, because it allows that issue to keep floating around as part of another story. Arnold Schwarzenegger, budget impasse.
And vice versa, too. I mean, look, if Whitman is running strong, I think that there is a recognition that something is going to have to be done among union leaders. A lot of them believe that something is going to give on the pension issue. And if they think that Brown's in trouble and they think that Whitman could win, they might try to cut a deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger on his way out the door. They might think they can get a better deal with Schwarzenegger than they could with Whitman.
Given what she's saying and yeah, exactly.
Right. So it works both ways. Now, and if that happens, I think, you know, the union to watch here is SEIU Local 1000, which represents about, I believe, 90,000, 95,000 state employees.
The largest representation of state workers.
Yeah.
And they haven't cut a contract deal, and their negotiations are
conflicting reports.
Iffy. We haven't met a lot.
We're meeting today. Yeah. Wait, we're not meeting. Right. But I do think that, you know, they can read poll numbers just like us, and it'll be interesting to see as we get closer to Election Day, if Whitman stays close or opens up a little lead, how that might impact some of those collective bargaining discussions.
The only other the other thing out there that just happened here at the end of the week on Thursday, a little bit before that, but Thursday was a big flare-up day on the climate change aspect of the governor's race, where Whitman finally released her positions on all the ballot measures in November, all of which were absolutely not shocking. Yes. Even the one that everybody watched, although that was the one everybody paid attention to, which is Prop 23, the suspension of the climate change law. She is opposed to that suspension. She says it's not as good of an idea as her plan for a one-year moratorium on implementing that climate change law.
Right.
And so Brown had already set up an event. Brown's been hammering for the last couple of days on her lack of taking a position. Because he's strongly against Prop 23, strongly for the climate change law, and says, look, she's trying to have it both ways. Then she released that statement early Thursday morning. See, I almost said it too, this morning.
See, almost.
It's not this
except
morning.
That you're a little bit better than me.
It's Friday morning.
Of course.
She released that statement early Thursday morning. Brown maybe caught a little flat-footed about whether the statement had come out, but nonetheless said, well, see, she still waffled too long. Climate change. I don't know where this one plays, but that is one of those issues that the polls have said voters like that law.
Well, right. And clearly Brown, you know, has made green energy and green jobs the centerpiece of his economic agenda, which
pretty much the only part of his economic
agenda. It really kind of sounds like the last thing that Democrats have to cling to in a political universe and with a set of issues that seem to be slipping away from them here in California. This has been an issue throughout the week. I mean, look, Proposition 23, let's be honest, it's essentially a repeal of AB 32. It would call for it to be suspended until unemployment is at 5.5% for four consecutive quarters. I'm not sure that that's ever happened. I mean,
and I don't want to veer into that
briefly.
Measure. But the challenge is that the initiative is written so murkily that the interpretation of how that unemployment rate lowers could, in effect, mean a forever suspension repeal of it. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So and essentially what Whitman has said is that within the law itself, within AB 32, there's a provision that allows for a 1-year suspension. And that's what she wants to do. But look, Whitman has, and even today, even in her statement, she reiterated the fact that AB 32, she believes, is a job killer. This, you know, that's the catchphrase that the Chamber of Commerce has made popular, and that's a buzzword for her base, or a catchphrase for her Republican base. But I do think that Brown is right that there, you know, in some ways she is trying to have it both ways. She wants to sort of be seen as a moderate, as a centrist, and doesn't want to be seen as somebody who's calling for the repeal of this environmental law. I mean, because environmental cred is important for voters. Now, whether it is the issue in this particular year, you know, clearly Brown thinks that it's important enough to talk about time and time again, and Whitman thinks it's important enough to try to hedge a little bit on her position.
I can't help it. But point out something, though. If Brown says she's trying to have it both ways, and Whitman has said a few times in campaign events, I'm an environmentalist, but that sounds like someone who paddles to the left, someone who paddles to the right.
And whose canoe theory of
politics is that?
Right.
Jerry Brown's, who long said that you've got to try to steer your course in the middle of the political debate. And perhaps that is she's taking a page out of the Jerry Brown playbook.
So, perhaps.
So we've got a debate next week. The first debate between Brown and Whitman on the campus of UC Davis here outside of Sacramento. I think a lot of people have to be watching that. Political debates don't often draw a huge audience, but I've got to think with people as undecided as they are in this poll and as conflicted, they're going to be looking for something that they can go, okay, I think I'll do X.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is comparable to sort of the first Bush-Gore debate, you know, in 2000, where you had a race that was seen as being up for grabs. And I can't remember a governor's race that was this.
Apparently, 1990, Dianne Feinstein, John Vandekamp. Somebody wrote online today.
In the Democratic primary? Or you mean Wilson Feinstein?
Wilson Feinstein in 90. That was the one that was the last one that was this close to the election.
And,
sorry.
That would make sense.
Yeah. True.
But that being said, I think you're right. There will be a lot of attention on this debate. There's another debate in the hamlet of Fresno on Saturday.
Is that Detroit or Fresno?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can talk about that if you'd like.
Go ahead with your – then I'll – yes.
And there's also going to be a U.S. Senate debate on Wednesday, no, via radio.
That would be public radio.
Yes.
Our friends in L.A., KPCC.
KPCC.
I think a lot of people are going to be watching this debate. If you don't know the Detroit comment, I just now have to fill in the blank just briefly. I think context is everything with this, but I'm going to end up butchering the context somehow where Meg Whitman, speaking to the editorial board of the San Jose Mercury News and the Bay Area News Group, said something like, have you been to Fresno? It's like Detroit.
It's awful.
It's
she
awful.
Said it's awful.
And then she clarified to say the rest of the context would be she's talking about the economy of Fresno in the Central Valley. Some
obviously not talking about the Giants AAA team, which is in Fresno.
The Grizzlies?
I don't know the name.
Grizzlies.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, see? Our Fresno folks will tell us this. But some people in Fresno, a little unhappy about that, a little bit of all day on Wednesday and Thursday. But anyway, you have enough of that. So let's talk about that Senate race. I'm stealing these poll numbers from Anthony York briefly. Field poll out on Friday.
Friday.
Not Thursday, Friday.
No, it's embargoed.
It's embargoed until 6 a.m., which is why the podcast isn't going up until 6 a.m.
Because I was up at 4 o'clock looking for it, and I couldn't find it.
Because I honor the embargo of the field poll, which—
unlike some tweeters who shall remain nameless.
Well, TV station that broke the embargo on the governor's poll and some others.
Yes.
And, I mean, I think I started seeing it like dinner time Wednesday night. The numbers of the field poll.
What time do you eat dinner? Well, let's move on,
shall we? All right. You don't need to know about my dinner schedule. I have two kids. I never eat dinner. Field poll on the race for Senate. Barbara Boxer, 47%. Carly Fiorina, 41%. 12% undecided. That represents a flat number for Boxer from July. She was also at 47% then. it represents a drop for Fiorina from 44% to 41% of the vote. And the undecideds have gone up a little bit. And this poll shows what I think all of us would know anyway, too, in another question it asked. Is your vote preference more of a vote for your candidate or against her opponent? Boxer voters say my vote, 67% of them say I'm voting for Barbara. Fiorina voters, 65%, I'm voting against Boxer.
Well, there you go. It's a Boxer referendum.
But therein does lie some of the challenge, I would think, for Fiorina. I mean, is, you know, making her case about herself versus making the case that Barbara Boxer is the wrong person. Well, and it also is amplified in Fiorina's first television ad, which she put out, which is that infamous piece of videotape where Senator Boxer told a general in a hearing, please call me senator.
Yeah, because she worked hard for the
title. But again, the whole ad is about Boxer and not about Fiorina.
Well, and something tells me that we'll read stories like this ad nauseum, especially after the election. But these poll numbers really do contrast the style of campaign run by Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman. Carly Fiorina has been more unabashedly conservative. She came out in favor of Proposition 23. She was embraced by Sarah Palin in the primary. She's run sort of more of a, for lack of a better phrase, more of a Tea Party campaign than Whitman. And Whitman has been more of a, has been kind of coy and is you know, is not as dynamic as Fiorina on the stump. And of course, Meg Whitman has spent $120-some-odd million, unlike, and Fiorina is having some financial issues now. Fiorina's run a more traditional conservative campaign, and I think that these poll numbers show that even though Barbara Boxer is probably more liberal than many Californians are, she has a way. She's proven herself to be a very tough campaigner. It's clear from these numbers that this race is going to be a referendum on Boxer, and that, you know, and as the Boxer campaign now starts hitting Fiorina on her record at HP, and all these things, it seems like those attacks are having an impact and driving Fiorina's numbers down.
Well, and I just got a couple of other sub numbers out of this on the Senate race, because for some of the people who will be listening to this, they haven't heard as much about this poll by the time they hear the podcast. But this goes again to your Tea Party comment and lots of things. 41% of the people surveyed by Field say they have some identification with the Tea Party, either a lot or a little bit. Those people strongly prefer Fiorina. 59% say they have no identification with it. They are very, 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 very strongly Boxer supporters. So it would seem as though Fiorina's base could be solid, but is her base big enough? And then that, I feel, somewhat is amplified here in other places too. You know, Boxer's ahead in most regions except the Central Valley. The question is, what percentage of the overall vote on Election Day will that be? Also, what I find interesting, one more, we talked about people who vote by mail. In the vote by mail category, Fiorina is only up by a point.
Right.
So it's effectively a dead even race. People who vote on Election Day, Boxer's up by 13 points. And so, again, this goes to this goes to who shows up to vote here.
And how certain people vote, right?
And how they feel. And, again, whether you have broaden beyond what your traditional base would be. And this, again, makes me feel like we should be talking about that comparison with the Whitman campaign,
right,
trying to paddle out somewhere in the middle of the political spectrum. And Fiorina, pretty much not.
She's been paddling near the banks, right? So
near the riverbank.
And to answer your rhetorical question there, is Fiorina's base big enough to win an election? No, it's not. I mean, you know, only 35% of the voters are going to be Republican. So it's not big enough. You need about a third of your vote to come from non-Republicans if you want to win as a Republican in this state, at minimum. So, you know, and we'll see. We've still got 6 weeks left. But you know, another problem for Fiorina is attracting money nationally. I mean, the National Republican Party has had some fundraising issues. But California, and this is where, I mean, California becomes, it's so expensive. There's so many seats up for grabs now. And, you know, for national Republicans to make a commitment to fund Fiorina, I mean, it would, for the price of funding a Fiorina campaign in California, you can fund three or four states, you know, Delaware, Alaska, I mean, you know, wherever the hot Senate races are going to be, you know, you get more bang for your buck playing in smaller states with cheaper media markets.
Last thing on this race, and then probably the last thing for the podcast, is if, in fact, the Senate race is a referendum on Boxer, does Boxer continue to do a negative ad focus on Fiorina?
Yes.
Rather than a positive on herself, given it's a referendum on her?
Well, I yes. Yes. I mean, just
because negative ads work.
Well, look, just use history as your guide. I mean, in terms of Boxer's campaign against Matt Fong and the campaign against Bruce Hershenson in 92. And I don't know, was the Bill Jones race? That never seemed felt like that was even really a race in 2004. But because that was a presidential year, a big Democratic year in California. But yeah, I mean, I think that it was a pretty blistering attack we saw from Boxer unloading on Fiorina after the one perfunctory positive spot that you need to begin with.
Helping veterans, helping something
right.
else.
Tax credits, right. Small business, and then bam. You know? All right, we got that out of the way. But in some ways, it feels like that's where Boxer's most comfortable. And I have no reason to believe that it's not going to be negative for the next 5 weeks or so.
And as you said, they've got a debate on public radio soon.
Yeah, I think Boxer will be phoning in from Washington, and and Fiorina will. I don't know if she's going to be in studio. I don't know.
I don't know how it
But
works.
I'll be listening and blogging on the LA Times.
Lucky you.
Yes.
Lucky you. And that'll do it for the podcast. Maybe next week we can talk about some budget stuff, but I sense probably not. And we'll have to talk about the debate, I guess, a little bit too.
Yeah, yeah.
Who
maybe
won, who lost. You know, hey, everybody else.
Who is wearing what?
Everyone else will have weighed in by then on that. Why don't we just stretch that all the
way
to Friday?
We'll be the definitive commentary here for you.
We'll be the final.
As you gear up for the weekend.
The final commentary and football picks. No.
There you go.
That actually could really increase our podcast.
We got a two candidate parlay if you call in now. This one is guaranteed.
My money's on the Colts this weekend. Okay, anyway.
All right.
For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. See you next time.